There are countless jobs that make a society function. What does it mean to perform a certain occupation? What are the day-to-day activities? This is Community Connections, and I'm your host, Heather Rose, and together, we aim to find out. This is Heather Rose of Community Connections. Joining us today is Dr. Michael Bentley, science educator and activist. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Rose.
Hey, can you give us a little background about yourself?
Well, I'm a native of Roanoke. I attended Roanoke Catholic High School and then went on to get a bachelor's degree in biology from King's College in Pennsylvania, master's at University of Pennsylvania, and ultimately my doctorate at the University of Virginia. And I have taught in the public schools 9.5 years. I started out as a high school biology teacher, and that was in Chicago and in Philadelphia. And I did that as a conscientious objector who was drafted during the Vietnam War, and I served my community service that way.
Great.
But that hooked me into teaching. I hadn't planned on that, but I loved it and continued teaching. And then ultimately, after I got all that experience as a teacher, I ended up becoming a teacher educator at the university level. And that's how I ended up. And I retired from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and I have moved back to Roanoke and become social justice and climate justice advocate ever since.
I knew it. My husband was like, it doesn't automatically mean that he's a climate change activist because he's a scientist. I was like, yes, it does.
During the time I was at UVA doing my doctoral studies, I took courses in earth science and learned about the climate. But I think my interest in climate was started when I was a first year teacher in Philadelphia back in 1969-70, and the principal there told me that since I was the newest hired, I was going to be in charge of the Earth Day celebrations with the senior class. And that turned out to be huge. And ever since, I have been following environmental issues. But at that time, I didn't know much about climate because it wasn't on my radar yet. Mostly, I was interested in pollution and dirty water, dirty air, which was prevalent at that time.
Well, isn't it like related? Aren't the two related?
It is. They are related. And we knew about climate early on. LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, addressed Congress in 1965 about CO2 in the atmosphere and the greenhouse effect. So he knew about it. And believe it or not, when Senator Joe Biden was a senator in 1989, he introduced the first action, bill to address climate change, to reduce emissions. Of course, it failed, and it never came back for many years after that. But certainly government officials knew about it before I did, but nothing ever was done about it. Gotcha. And we know why.
Profit?
Oh, no. The oil industry was in total. They knew about it, and they were into disinformation right from the get-go. Just like the tobacco industry, they used the same playbook deny and promote fossil fuels. You know, like the tobacco industry did deny there was anything wrong with smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us about your current work?
I'm still active as a scholar. I'm working on a book right now with my colleague, Stephen Fleury. We've written a lot of papers together and we're working on a book. Yeah. And he was here visiting last night, spent the night with his wife here at our house. And he's on his way to Chapel Hill and for an event down there. But we've got a lot of work to do. He's still teaching full time at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York. Mm-hmm. So we have to do most of our work during the summers when he's off. But that's a project we're working on. And I'm doing a presentation at the Virginia Association of Science Teachers Conference in a couple weeks. That's a virtual conference. So actually, I've already finished my presentation and submitted it as a video, a YouTube video. So it's done. And it is about, my presentation is about student anxiety over climate change. There's been a lot of research lately about high anxiety among children because they know what's going on. Students today, of course, don't just go to school and learn things. They're not getting this so much from their teachers, but from social media and from all of the conversations they have with their parents and with schoolmates. And they're anxious about it. Of course, they know about Greta Thunberg, the Sunrise Movement, and other movements that are trying to get kids active in doing something about climate change, because they're the ones that are going to suffer the most when the crap hits the fan in a few years, and it's coming. I'll probably be on my way 6 feet under.
Yeah.
And it's the children that are going to have to suffer with what we sapiens have done to the planet, I'm afraid.
Yeah. What's your prediction?
About the kids or?
Right. What's your prediction about the progression of climate change? Because there's been, you know, numerous, you know, like my husband says, you know, like they say it's going to be like in 7 years, we're going to all die, or 14 years or.
Well, I follow it really closely. It's my major issue now because I think it is an existential threat to civilization as well as the natural world. Right now, we've raised the temperature of the Earth globally 1.2 degrees Celsius. They've been trying to enact agreements from nations right now at the UN's COP26, which is going on right now as we speak. They've been trying to get the limit to 1.5 degrees Celsius. I don't think we're going to be able to manage that. We'll be lucky to get it under 2 degrees if people cooperate. But if it gets to 3 degrees, which I think really is likely because we're still increasing our emissions.
Yeah.
And 3 degrees is really catastrophic when it gets to 3 degrees. But the models which really match the observations very closely, even models that go back to 1972, believe it or not, the Club of Rome, which was written by a bunch of MIT scientists before 1972. But those computer models, when computers weren't all that good and they didn't have all the data, so far have matched the observations pretty accurately. And it looks like we could even get as high as 6 degrees, close to 6 degrees by 2100. That, right, I can't even imagine how bad that would be if that happens. And, you know, people don't realize 2100 sounds like a long way off, but that's just, what, about 80 years away, right? That's 79 years. And they talk about 2030. Well, that's only 29 years from now. And scientists say if we don't get a handle on this, we've got 8 years left to really get the emissions down. And at the current rate, it's very unlikely. Most people don't know that we've already hit several tipping points. And a tipping point is irreversible. Once it's initiated, you can't walk it back.
Like what?
Well, the most recent tipping point, I read a paper just a couple weeks ago. And it really hasn't been reported in the mainstream media yet that the Earth's albedo has decreased. As a person who has taught about this at the university level for years, I always taught that the albedo of the Earth was 30%.
What's the albedo?
The albedo is the reflectance of the Earth. You know, it's what Earthshine is. If you look at a crescent moon, you can see the whole moon. As you know, the crescent is really bright, but if you look at the moon, you can see the rest of it. Well, the only reason you can see the rest of it is the shine that comes from the Earth, from the sun. It's the sunlight that hits the Earth and radiates to the moon. And that's the albedo of the Earth. That's the reflectance of the sun. And that has declined to 29.5% in just two decades, in just 2020, because the ice has melted in the Arctic. The ice is gone. The ice is gone. And it's not coming back. It's too late. The ice is not, the ocean's too warm. It won't, it's not going to refreeze. We had temperatures last year in the, and this year in the Arctic that were over 100 degrees in the Arctic Circle, in Siberia, and in also in Canada. We had temperatures in Canada of 110 degrees in Canada, and along the West Coast.
What's the average in Canada?
Oh my gosh. That's 20 degrees above the average. It's,
wow.
You know, it's unheard of. It's just unprecedented. And the permafrost is melting, which release the methane hydrates release methane. Methane's a very powerful, 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. Every single measure is negative. So that's one feedback loop that has been initiated that hasn't even been reported yet.
Well,
you
heard it on RFR.
It's not one that is even in the models. They don't have the albedo in the climate models. Wow. I mean, this is an effect, a self-reinforcing feedback loop that isn't even in the models. It's a bad sign, a very bad sign. Anyway, my prediction is that we need to start planning to how to adapt to it, because we're not going to be able to prevent it. The prevention phase is, that ship has sailed. And now we have to look at how do we mitigate, and manage to keep as many people from dying off as possible. There are going to be mass migrations from this. The things are happening so fast. That's the other thing about what's going on, is the pace of the change in the natural world from what we've initiated with these greenhouse gases. It's happening so fast, way faster than scientists had imagined in the models. All the curves are going straight up. So just like we heard during early days of COVID, when Dr. Fauci was saying, we need to flatten the curve, that's the only thing we can do now. We have more CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere now than has been there in 800,000 years. And we know these measurements very accurately because we've got satellites up there. Satellites measuring the forest cover of the Earth, measuring how much CO2 is in the air. Of course, we also measure it on the land in observatories all over the Earth. It hit 419 parts per million this summer. It's now 415 parts per million. Well, when I was born in 1946, it was 310 parts per million, you see? Yeah, so it's gone from 310 to 415 parts per million in my lifetime.
Well, what
bleak. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but it's not
good. Okay. What can we do to mitigate the crisis?
We can try to be resilient. I'm going to be speaking before Salem City Council in a couple of weeks at their next meeting. They actually have a meeting in three more days, that early next week, Monday, they have a meeting. But the next meeting, 2 weeks after that, I'll be speaking about climate change and what the city of Salem can do. Not that I expect them to do anything. Salem is very conservative, but I have to keep speaking out. And what we need to do is we need to flatten the curve. And that means we need to get off fossil fuels ASAP as fast as we can. We need to approve locally the Rocky Forge Wind Farm, get that going. We need to put more solar panels on houses as soon as possible. We need to build solar into our infrastructure. And we need to start conservation and efficiency measures beyond what we are doing now. We need to move to electric vehicles as fast as possible. All of those kinds of things will flatten the curve. That's not to say that we're not going to have a catastrophe, but it will make it come more slowly so that we can prepare for it. If it comes fast, there's going to be a collapse. I really do believe that it's going to be a collapse of governments. There's going to be, if we think we have people at the border now, we haven't seen what's possible. Mm-hmm. People are going to be migrating from here from all over the world and you know, wherever they can get. Some people, the rich, have already decided that this is going to happen. And the gazillionaires and the billionaires are building houses in New Zealand. That's about the safest place you can ride this out.
Why?
If you can really ride it out, I don't think anybody can ride it out. It's going to be global.
You know, this Why is New Zealand?
It's isolated. It's got the ocean surrounding it, which mitigates its temperature changes. Mm-hmm. It's an island, although, of course, there'll be sea level rise there, too. But it's high enough that it won't cover the whole place like it will the Maldives and some other islands that will completely flood over in Miami and much of Florida. Yeah. So although, you know, in looking at the scope of things, where we live right now in the Roanoke Valley, if you had to stay in the United States, this is one of the better places to be.
Hmm. Well, great.
Don't move. Yeah. Don't move to California.
Silver linings.
Silver linings, yeah. Yeah, I didn't make that. That wasn't in my calculations when I moved back home. I came home to be near family, but but it turns out that this is this area along the Blue Ridge is not a bad place to be. Virginia Beach is not a good place to be.
Okay. Well, I'll tell my friend Celeste.
Yeah. Don't invest in beach property. That's a bad investment right now. Yeah.
What is constructivist science and why do we want it in our classrooms?
Well, science education has been ruled in Virginia by the SOLs, which most parents will recognize right away, and of course teachers will as well, for, I don't know, 30 years now, three decades at least, back to the 80s when it began. And there has been absolutely not one iota of evidence that it has improved science education or the SOLs have improved education in any field of endeavor. There's no evidence that standards and high stakes testing has improved education one whit. And it just keeps going like it's an inertial thing that they just keep doing the same thing over and over again, even though it hasn't worked. And teachers, most teachers that I know, and I know a lot of teachers, hate the SOLs. They hate the tests. They hate the fact that after the test, they have 3 or 4 weeks left to teach, with the kids not being, you know, thinking it's all been done since they've done the SOL test. It's just such a bad system. And it goes against the best theories of how students learn, which is what you asked me about, which is best described by in academic educational circles at the university level. We call that constructivism. Mm. And it really comes out of the work. It goes back to the early 1900s from John Dewey. And then Piaget, Jean Piaget, from Switzerland, and other scholars of Vygotsky in Russia, who theorized that students learn by building their own knowledge from reading, from listening, from doing activities that they then think about. So people quote John Dewey as saying, we learn by doing. Probably heard that phrase, you learn by doing. He never said that. What he said was, we learn by thinking. Mm-hmm. So we need curriculum that involves students thinking about what they've done and heard and read and seen. And the SOLs is more of a curriculum where they are taught facts that are likely to be on a test. And there's fear that runs that they're going to fail. And anything run on fear in education is going to fail. Mm-hmm. That's not the motivation you need. The motivation you need for science education is curiosity.
Right.
And our schools don't produce curious kids. You know, it was observed by Carl Sagan many years ago that he said, you know, I go to a kindergarten class and I see all these kids with a million questions and just wanting to know everything. Then I go to a class of seniors in high school. They don't want to know. They're not interested in anything. Mm-hmm. So he says, what happened?
What happened?
You know, and what happened was the curriculum, which failed to produce that curiosity.
Well, that brings us to our next question. What problems do you see in our science classroom and how would you go about fixing them?
Well, we have a good model right here in the Roanoke Valley. And that is community school.
Right. I went to community school for a little bit.
You did?
Yeah. For the extended studies, I was dual enrolled in Hollins and community school. It was before they had their high school.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was on the board of community school for many years. And also, I was a founder of community high school, one of the several people that founded community high school.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that's somewhere on my vita. But at any rate,
okay.
Community school worked wonders for my own three children.
Mm-hmm.
It taught them to speak in public, to think on their feet, and it maintained their curiosity for learning.
Mm-hmm.
And it did a lot of outdoor activities. It did Friday groups, as you know, where they can choose a workshop to be in. In fact, my son right now is doing a Friday group at community school. He's 27 years old. He's a scientist, and he's here from Ecuador, where he lives and works. And he's still connected with the teachers that he knows at community school, and they asked him to do this class. So as we speak, he's at community school, and I hope he doesn't come crashing in the door and make noise. It's about time for him to get back. But community school has small classes. It does not follow the SOLs. It has interest groups. It teaches each individual child according to what their interests and capacity are. And it's non-discriminatory. It's got all kinds of students in terms of their backgrounds and economic means. And it just was a very wonderful experience for my kids. And it's a good model for what schools could be like. There is also another model in Bedford, Virginia. It's Virginia's first forest school has just cut their ribbon a couple weeks ago. And that's going to be a school in which children K through 12 are educated entirely outdoors.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So there are some models of what could be. Unfortunately, though, those are private schools.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any models in public schools because the public schools have to teach the SOLs, so they are constrained in their inventiveness and what they can do by the SOLs. And that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
There ought to be all kinds of experimentation. We need the schools to be teaching kids how to be resilient and how to prepare for what's coming. And we know what's coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're not doing that. We're failing our students.
What is the importance of connecting children to nature?
Well, if you don't love something, you're not going to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can get kids to love nature is to have them experience it at some deep levels and be in it. And that's another thing that's not happening in the public schools. When they have SOLs, they're afraid to take a field trip day because administrators think that's wasting time. You're not working on your SOLs and preparing for those tests. So there aren't very many field trips. Now, prior to the SOLs, when I taught in the public schools in Virginia, I had the freedom, given the permission of the parents and the principal, to take kids out. I took kids caving.
Mm.
I took kids on bicycle trips.
Nice.
I took kids backpacking in the James River Face Wilderness area. I took kids fossil hunting. I took kids at night. We went out and we went up to the Blue Ridge Parkway and we looked at meteor showers and we looked at constellations and we studied the planets. In reality, we can do those things, mm-hmm. but there's no incentive for teachers to take those efforts to do those things because it doesn't prepare them for the SOL test.
So who's responsible for the SOLs implementing them? Is that politicians?
Yes, of course. It was passed by the Virginia General Assembly many, many years ago, and it was initiated. The whole thing was initiated by it was bipartisan, but it really got its major emphasis when Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas and chair of the governor's conference, and he was a big pusher for that. And of course, he became president later on. So it's another thing that the Clintons are involved in that turned out to be negative.
Oh, dear.
And we're stuck with.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. So it goes back to that time. And it followed a report called A Nation at Risk, which came out during the just before Reagan became president. And A Nation at Risk was the lead author of that. The leader of that was a CEO of IBM. So, you know, it was a corporate thing.
Uh-huh.
And the corporations have benefited from it. They're the ones that create the tests. Millions of dollars every year go to Harcourt and the other test makers to create these tests. And so they're all for keeping it going, you know.
Absolutely.
It's another one of those things. The corporations don't care about the future. They just care about the next quarterly bottom line.
Right. Well, what kind of activities connect children to nature?
They can be very simple activities. They can happen on their playground. They can involve during the spring and the fall before it gets cold, looking at insects, looking at ants, getting down on the ground, moving your fingers through grass and seeing what you can find with a magnifying glass. It can be having a school garden, planting seeds in the classroom and then taking them outside and putting them in the ground and watching them grow, using a ruler to measure their growth, making graphs from that and integrating math into what they're doing. It can be taking trail walks. It can be going to streams and ponds and knocking around the rocks with a net and catching the macro invertebrates that live on the bottom of the stream, which are amazing things to find.
Mm-hmm.
It can be looking at a roadkill and examining what it looks like. And,
so disturbing.
There are a lot of things because nature can be, you know, even on a rainy day, nature can be brought inside the classroom. You can go to the Kroger and have the butcher save you an eyeball from a cow head or get you one. And you can dissect an eyeball and look at the eye of a cow and compare it to your own eye. So looking at real stuff, rocks, minerals, fossils, you can do so many things with kids with real things. And there's so many things that can be done outside. Kids can collect leaves and learn how to identify the trees in their schoolyard or in their environment. You can take kids, if it's a school in a neighborhood, you can walk the sidewalks of the neighborhood with groups of kids, and you can look at what the houses in the neighborhood are built of, and you can find out, what is a brick? What's in a brick? How do you make a brick? How do you put bricks together? There's so many questions, and, you know, it's all about the questions and the thinking about the answers.
Well, do you know what's in a brick?
Sure, they're made out of earth and they're held together by cement, and cement produces carbon dioxide. It's one of the biggest producers of carbon dioxide in the world.
Really?
So making a lot of cement is a problem.
Right. You know? Roads and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Dear.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us about worm spit integrating curriculum through a study of silk and the amazing silkworm? What's so amazing about it?
That was one of the papers that I published with my good friend Teresa Aldridge, who's a retired teacher in the Salem Public Schools. We wrote that, and Teresa is my inspiration for that because she actually did it in her classroom. I never did it in my classroom, but I did it with groups of teachers in my classes with teachers. Silkworms are fascinating. And they're easy to grow. They can't fly away because they don't have wings. So there's no danger of them escaping.
Oh, dear. But
they can go through a whole life cycle in your classroom. And you can connect silkworm study with history and cultural studies and social studies because they had silk has had an amazing, you've heard of the Silk Road.
No.
It goes from China all the way to Europe. All the silk was traded back in the Middle Ages for many, many years. The Chinese were the ones that cultivated these little critters and really domesticated. These are domesticated insects.
Wow.
And there's a whole fascinating history to them. And the kids can actually get the cocoons. The silk comes from the cocoons when they turn into their pupa stage. So you can learn about metamorphosis in nature. Not all the insects go through complete metamorphosis. Most of them go through some form of metamorphosis, but silkworms go through complete metamorphosis. So they form larvae and they form pupae and then they go to an adult stage, but you can unwrap that just like the Chinese learn to do, unwrap that cocoon and then put the threads together and weave them into silk, which is an amazing substance.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful classroom activity that goes on for weeks while the animals grow from the tiny little seed that you can barely see with your magnifying. They're not seeds, but they're eggs.
Yeah.
They go from eggs, but they're the size of a little tiny seed. And they go from a little egg to a little worm. To a little larvae that crawls around, and you can measure it and keep a graph of how big it gets.
Cool.
Then it goes into wrapping itself into a cocoon, and then it emerges as a little moth. It can't fly because it's been bred not to be able to fly and fly.
Really?
Away. Yeah, yeah.
But so, it can't. It has wings, but it can't fly.
Right. It has wings, little unusable wings.
What do they look like? Why are they unusable? Can they use them? Or they just don't refuse to use them?
They can't fly with them. They can flap them around a little bit, but they can't go anywhere with them. And of course, just like with some of the butterflies that we see, the adult stage has one purpose, to mate and have new eggs. So the real lifespan, the most of the lifespan is as a larvae going around eating. And they only eat one thing, mulberry leaves.
Oh, really?
And there are mulberry leaves all over our area. We have them along the Roanoke River. And so Teresa would go out to the greenway and pick leaves off the mulberry trees and feed them to her, take them to her fifth grade class at Salem Elementary school that she taught at, which was, and then, feed them to the larvae.
They won't eat anything else? Like,
they won't eat anything
but mulberry leaves. They know the difference.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's so weird. They won't eat like a maple leaf or an elm or just a mulberry.
No. They will starve to death if they don't have a mulberry leaf. I happen to have a mulberry tree in my backyard. So
cool.
It was easy for me to get the mulberry leaves when we, used it in my class. So that's about worm spit. But in that particular article, we talked about how you can integrate that into social studies and teach kids about China and its empires and textiles and what textiles are, how old textiles are. There's just so many connections to it.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a good, rich school curriculum is one that's interrelated, where you can interrelate math and social studies and science and reading, so kids can read about this. There's so many books in the libraries about the Silk Road and about silkworms. You don't even need to have a science book to do it. You know, you can use library books.
Nice.
So it's just a great thing to do in a classroom. So in the workshops I did at Hollins University for 7 years for science teachers, every summer, we always did the silkworms. We grew the little babies and the teachers worked with them.
So what is your advice to parents and educators?
Try to get your government representatives to do away with the SOLs would be the best thing. And then free teachers to be professionals. Unfortunately, teachers aren't trusted. And we see that today with what's going on with this critical race theory drama that Mr. Youngkin raised, and where he says, let the teachers control the curriculum. Well, we ought to let the teachers control the curriculum because they've been trained to do it. Parents haven't, especially parents that are, you know, never graduated from high school. And we've got a lot of them around here that want to control the curriculum. The teachers are the professionals, not the politicians or the parents. And in my opinion, it's the teachers, professionally trained teachers, who should be competent. Not all of them are, of course, but then not all policemen are competent. Not all nurses and doctors
That's
are
right.
competent. Right? You know, there's always losers in every profession.
Right. But
most teachers love what they're doing and would love it even more if they didn't have the SOLs to deal with.
That's right.
So that's the first thing to do. Get rid of that burden and let teachers teach.
Okay.
And you know, each individual community could decide through their school board and teachers working together. I believe in collective bargaining with teachers and administrators and school boards. And that can involve what's taught and how it's taught. When I first taught, I was in Pennsylvania, which passed a law that allowed teachers to collectively bargain. And I was on the negotiation team there, and I learned how to do that. And we did some wonderful things. I was able to get the school board to invest in upgrading the science labs in the high school and bringing in one of the new National Science Foundation funded science programs at the time. And we have a wonderful National Science Program funded program now called FOSS, F-O-S-S, for Full Option Science System. It's goes from kindergarten to eighth grade. That's a wonderful hands-on science program, and it can't be used in Virginia.
Why?
It doesn't fit with the SOLs.
Oh, okay. Well, I've always, what is critical race theory? Can you define that? I mean, I think I know.
Well, it's the actual history of the United States, basically.
That's what I thought. I was like, man, that is white fragility at its finest.
Yeah, it's white fragility and it's white supremacy. They don't want the truth to be known about how people were treated in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Critical race theory is about racism that is institutionalized in so many ways, like voter suppression laws and Jim Crow laws and what happened with the lynchings. You know, we had lynchings right here in Roanoke, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Well, kids ought to know about that. Maybe not kindergarten kids, but certainly kids, you know, in middle school and high school can handle that.
Definitely.
We can go over to Old Southwest and see where the tree was. If they you know, the tree's been cut down, but you know, it's just off of Fifth Street.
Yeah. And don't forget the Trail of Tears and the Native American genocide.
How the Native Americans were treated, which was horrible.
Horribly.
And you know, we need to get people like Jackson off of our $20 bill. Of course, he was Donald Trump's favorite president, and he was one of the cruelest people that ever occupied the office.
Really?
Yeah, well, he was the one that caused the genocide. He's the one that fostered the eradication of the buffalo, which were the food for the Native Americans.
Aww.
Starve them out, wanted to starve them to death. Yeah, that's the kind of history that needs to be taught. We need to know what we've done.
Yeah.
And it's, we need to know the truth, basically. It's not that we're teaching untruths.
Yeah. But, well, what are you going to do with that? I mean...
Well, you're hopefully going to try to get kids to create a conscience about what civic life should be and what a democracy should be like.
Right.
So that they make good decisions, that they vote, and they become active citizens and engaged. We you know, normally don't get 40% of the people voting in, for the governor's race. We had the highest percentage in a long time this last one, mainly because the Republicans were all enthused about getting rid of our very progressive Northam administration, which actually passed some decent laws, laws that restricted guns passed made marijuana legal. Mm-hmm. I never thought I'd ever see that in Virginia in my lifetime.
Well, it's kind of like a weird law that made it legal. It's like, well, you can't.
It's not perfect, but
yeah,
it's
something.
It's something, right? They did something. They actually did something. They also did something in Virginia about climate change under Northam. So those things got through. So it enraged the Republican faithful, and so we got what we got. And of course, the Democrats nominated Mr. Mick Offel, as you used that
phrase.
Yeah. They picked him out of a large field that did contain some very progressive Black women who would have made much better candidates for governor. But it's just like they picked Biden instead of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
So
he was robbed.
Oh, yeah. That's
true. What would be the consequences to society if we fail to educate our children adequately?
Well, the children will be the ones that will suffer from that. They're not going to be able to handle the changes that are coming from climate change if they don't know about it, and they don't know how it's caused, and they don't know what to do to flatten the curve. So they're the ones that are going to suffer the most, unfortunately. And I don't know any parent that would want that for their children, that they would be suffering in the future, that they would have a less chance of a happy life than they did.
Mm-hmm.
We all want our children to have at least as good a life, if not a better life, than we did.
Right.
That's not going to happen under the current situation. There's just no way it's going to happen. Unless, of course, these parents are billionaires and can afford to, prop the kids up in a safe location with lots of automatic weapons to protect their food, which is, I'm afraid, going to be the case for some people, some places.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of guns out there.
Yeah.
Well, if society breaks down, it's going to be the people with the guns that are more likely to get through it.
Survive.
Yeah.
Do you have guns?
Yeah. I have no guns.
Oh, no, you're not going to survive and get through it.
Well, I'm not going to have to face the worst of it because I'm 75 years old.
Okay. Well, I hope you have a much longer life.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I will do my best. I'm taking my vitamins.
Yeah. My great-grandmother lived to be 103.
Wow, you got good genes then. That's great.
Yeah. Can you describe your activist work?
I work with several different organizations to educate and to lobby. One of them is the Sierra Club, Roanoke Group Sierra Club. We have about Roanoke Group is a regional group of the Virginia chapter of the Sierra Club. And we have in our area about 800 Sierra Club members. And I'm the secretary of that, of our group. And we hold demonstrations. There's one on Saturday at the, we've been holding it lately at the, it's every month, first Saturday of the month from 11 to noon. It's been down on the market, but because of COVID, we've moved it temporarily to the UU Church so that we don't have a lot of intimate interactions with passerbys that we don't know if they've been vaccinated or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's this Saturday. And then the Sierra Club has also been very instrumental in working to get the Rocky Forge Wind Farm going. I've testified before the Botetourt County Board of Supervisors about that. And that has finally, I think, is going to go through and be built. Then I also have been a longtime volunteer for Plowshare Peace and Justice Center. And Plowshare is also interested in climate change, but they're also concerned with social justice issues. And we also have anti-war protest that we do on the third Saturday of every month from noon to 1 o'clock down on the market with our masks on. And we try to educate people. We give out a flyer to tell them how much money we've been spending on the wars.
Yeah, lots of money.
War on terror. Yes, the Afghanistan war has cost well over $1 trillion.
Yeah.
And has gotten us nowhere.
Nowhere.
$1 trillion. The war in Iraq, of course, was a complete error of judgment. Mm-hmm. Today, they're burying Colin Powell, who was lauded by the media, but is a war criminal. He sold us. He sold us lies to the UN. Rumsfeld, Bush, all those people that sold us Iraq are war criminals. Mm-hmm. We had a preemptive invasion, which of a country that was a sovereign nation. That's a crime against humanity. That's illegal under the United Nations. And yet nothing happened to us because we're the ones with all the guns. So they all got away with it. But that was wrong.
Yeah.
We bring those things out at these demonstrations with the flyers that are different every month. I'm on the board for Plowshare. We also lobby. We've lobbied our congressman against the Pentagon budget and against the money that we fund Israeli oppression of the Palestinians. Every year, the United States gives Israel $3.8 billion
for
weapons to keep the Palestinians in an open-air prison in Gaza, where they can't get out. They can't get out for any reason. And those that are in Ramada or other places have very difficult time getting out to go to the grocery store or to buy things. They have to go through these gates and show their papers and get humiliated on a constant basis. And this just keeps on. And their land is continually being stolen by illegal settlers. The new Israeli government just approved another, I think, something like 13,000 houses that are all going to be illegal on Palestinian land. It's not compensated.
Well, it's all Palestinian land.
It's all Palestinian. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it was not an empty territory when that was formed by the British government. The British government had no right to decide that was going to happen. And of course, the United States has been supporting Israel no matter what they do, no matter what crime they commit. There's no penalty to whatever they do. So Plowshare tries to make all of those things more well known in the Roanoke area and try to get people to be educated about war and how bad it is for everything. So I do that. And then more recently, I've been one of the founders of an organization called RAISE, R-A-I-S-E, and that stands for Roanoke Area Stewards of the Earth, which is a local branch of Interfaith Power and Light. And here we're working with churches, trying to get them to recognize environmental issues and preach about environmental responsibility, responsibility to the animals, wildlife, and to other people in other countries about environmental issues. So those three organizations are the ones I most work with lobbying and that sort of thing. I'm on their speakers bureau. I spoke last week. I gave a presentation about climate change at Friendship Manor to the residents there. And I was told that there was a man that would be attending that was really a complete, he did not believe in climate change. And he was a science teacher, and he did not believe in science. And this man came in and told me up front, I don't believe in the thing you're going to say. And I actually changed his mind.
How? How do you do that? You can't.
I got an email from the lady that invited me to give the presentation, the events coordinator out there at Friendship. She said that the man had come to her office and told her that I had changed his mind.
How did you do that?
Well, I knew that he was a science teacher.
Yeah.
So I played off of that and showed him the graphs and the data and talked about how the data was collected and how it was interpreted. And, you know, I kept saying, you know, we have these models. The models are based upon data, and they're the best data we have. They're data from NASA and from NOAA, our government organizations. They're collected by satellites and by monitors on buoys all over the world. This is not made up. This is factual. And I saw him during the presentation, he started nodding his head. And
yeah.
I said, "Ooh, I think I got him." I don't necessarily claim that I can get all the skeptics, but that was when I did finally learn I had a success.
Yeah, pretty convincing.
Yeah, it worked. So,
well, thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you. I see we're almost out of time, and it was good talking to you, Heather, and Robert as well. And I appreciate being asked.
Absolutely. You have been listening to Heather Rose of Radio Free Roanoke Community Connections, speaking with Dr. Michael Bentley, science educator and activist, on 95.7 FM.